Taxation number 11237, Real 1.
Admiral Morgan Giles, Real 1. I think when you were a midshipman before the war, you served in the China fleet. Can you tell me about that, please?
Yes, I can. My first job as a midshipman was as appointed to the China fleet. And to get out there, I was sent to a little Australian destroyer, HMAS Voyager, which made a great name for itself later on in the war. And I remember going down with my father to have a look at this funny little old-fashioned ship in Portsmouth Dockyard, which I was supposed to join at exactly 9 o'clock the next morning. And in those days, you went on board with your dirk and your little white gloves. And I went down to this destroyer the night before to see where she was and see that she wasn't, so I shouldn't be late. And the ship was quite deserted and quite empty the night before, except that a man in a dirty singlet came out of the officer's galley, blew his nose over the side without a handkerchief, and went back in again. And an illustration of the extraordinary sort of starry-eyed way in which one sets out and then comes bump up against the realities of life. Anyway, I joined the next morning as the dockyard clock struck nine, and the ship was then alive with people pulling the torpedoes back out of the tubes and that sort of business. And I stepped across all this lot with my white gloves and my dirk, as I said, and I saw a lieutenant, and I went up to him and saluted and said the time-honored formula, "Come aboard to join, sir, please." And he replied in a strong Australian accent, "Oh, how interesting, but I'm the engineer officer." And so that was the second deflation for me. Anyway, it was a fascinating trip in this little ship and very much basic stuff. We went through the Med and Suez Canal and out to Singapore. We were then transferred on up to the China fleet from there, while these flotilla of little old destroyers went on down to Australia. In China, I joined first HMS Cumberland. There were five county-class cruisers out there then, beautiful ships to live in, and I joined in Hong Kong, and I thought Hong Kong must be the most glamorous place in the world. And the trouble is, I still think that, although I know that by now it's just an absolute ant heap, because of course in those days the population was perhaps a tenth of what it is now.
Why was the China station such a good station to serve on?
Why was it so good? Well, it was adventurous, and while I was... there was a lot of piracy up and down that coast, and remember, I was 19 or something, full of, you know, adventure stories and things. And during the time, I was lent to another destroyer, HMS Defender, to get destroyer experience. And we were sent out chasing pirates, and I was landed, I remember, in a whaler in charge of 8 to 10 sailors, all armed to the teeth and that sort of thing. And, of course, we found a ship's lifeboat from this pirated ship, waterlogged, and we rowed into a little remote little village in behind a place called Goat Island. And when we landed there, there was no possibility of finding any pirates. There wasn't a single person on the waterfront who could talk any English at all or anything, whatever. So we just clambered up on the jetty and sort of looked at them, and they looked at us, and then we got back to the boat and pulled back on board again. There was nothing else we could do. But piracy was a very great feature of life out there, and there's one rather extraordinary story that I recall. I was again lent from the Cumberland to HMS Eagle, which was an aircraft carrier, the old HMS Eagle. And we were lying in Weihai Wei, where we always went in the summer, right up in the anchorage in the north, the sort of fleet anchorage in the north, where from which we did our exercises and so on. And a funny little broken-nosed little coaster called the Shantien came in from Port Arthur or Darien or somewhere into Weihai Wei, and she was pirated on the passage. And the way it happened was they carried a lot of steerage passengers, you see, and the pirates would mingle with the steerage passengers, and then in the middle of the night they'd dash up on the bridge, knock the officer watch on the head, and take the ship into some little place and loot and take away everything they wanted to, and then escape in sampans.
What kind of size of group were the pirates operating in?
Oh, a handful. Just a handful.
And what size of ship might they be able to capture?
Well, this ship was a little coaster of about, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 tons. And that's exactly what they did. And so much so that these ships had iron railings so that the pirates were not able to get up from where the steerage people were kept on deck for a short passage to get onto the bridge and take control of the ship. But somehow these people got through a coal bunker, or they climbed around the end or did something.
Seems extraordinary that the Chinese government, rather than the Royal Navy, shouldn't have been putting a stop to it.
But the Chinese government had no writ. Chinese was ruled in those days by local warlords, as I'll explain to you in a minute. Anyway, this Shun Tien came in, and she staggered into Wei Hai Wei a couple of days late, and she said to the commander-in-chief, old Sir Frederick Dreyer, we've been pirated. And he said, yes, bad luck, it's always happening, isn't it? And they said, yes, and they've got two of your lieutenants as hostages. Oh, he said, that's another matter altogether, because there were two Royal Navy lieutenants who were joining. They were called Field and Luce, and David Luce afterwards became First Sea Lord in the fullness of time. And he was joining a submarine out there, I think called the Rainbow. And so when the pirates were looting the ship, they came upon two tousle-haired Englishmen in pyjamas and said, all right, you come with us, tumbled them into a junk and took them ashore somewhere. Well, when the commander-in-chief heard that these chaps were missing, he ordered the whole fleet to raise steam, and we had an enormous fleet out there in those days. We had these five big cruisers, a great big cruiser mine layer, a complete flotilla of destroyers, many, many submarines, and two aircraft carriers, extraordinary the size of the China fleet then. Anyway, this whole caravansary raised steam, and we steamed along the north coast of China trying to find these hostages. And as I say, I was an Eagle at the time, and they flew off biplane aircraft called Fairy 3F, and they were searching around, roaming around, looking for these things. And when we got to the mouth of the Yellow River, miles and miles up in the mud banks in the Yellow River, they saw two white chaps waving from the deck of a junk. And of course, there was no radio between the aircraft and the carrier in those days. So they came back and landed on, sort of dramatic chaps with leather jackets and coloured scarves and all this stuff, and reported they'd seen these people. Well, the wardroom messman, who was a Chinaman, this is literally as it happened, produced a wardroom menu card and wrote on it blood-curdling messages for the pirates saying, release your captives or fire will come from heaven and strike you. And this was put in a little message bag with long ribbons on it and flown out by an ex-aircraft and dropped on this junk. Well, the pirates had quite enough of it by this time. Incidentally, a couple of little bombs the size of a teapot were dropped in the mud, like firecrackers, you see, just to sort of lend strength to the words on the message. And the pirates had enough of it by this time, because, you see, they'd never seen foreign devils flying through the sky before. It was completely new to them. So they were very frightened, and they put these two lieutenants into a sampan and pushed them out into the river, and the tide brought them down to the mouth, towards the mouth of the river. And then a third aircraft went out, which was the same Fairy 3F, but on floats, and picked these chaps out of the sampan, and then got them back in on board and the flagship, or the Eagle, I suppose. And then the commander chief said, right, that's it, boys, back we all go to Wei Hai Wei. All this took about a 3-day operation. And I remember it very vividly. I've got a photograph of the Shun Tien. But The difference is that I bet that the Ariel Commander-in-Chief did this operation and told the Admiralty about it afterwards by radio. Nowadays, he would have asked the first and the Foreign Office to say, don't do it, so I don't know what would have happened. That is an illustration of how different things are nowadays, obviously. And also, in reply to your question, the Chinese government had absolutely no control of those outstations, backward parts like that at all.
How did Chinese people react to you as foreigners? Was there any xenophobia?
Absolutely the very reverse. They were perfectly, perfectly friendly. And, of course, there were a large number of Chinese, called unofficial Chinese, serving actually in the fleet. The cooks and stewards would be actually signed on naval ratings, but there would be also unofficial Chinese tailors, boot repairers, haircutters, laundrymen, and so on in the ships, as there have been until recent years.
Did they give good service?
Marvellous service, fantastic service. And I have been back 20, 30 years afterwards, and some chap who was a boy who would lash up your hammock or something would welcome you and remember your name. They're most amazing people. And they're spotlessly clean, and I can't speak enough good for them. I can't say enough good for them. And just as a flash forward, so to speak, when I was in HMS Belfast, out in the Far East, we had a laundry firm on board. We had 777 sailors on board. All wore spotless white uniform, and that had to be cleaned somehow. And this was laundered by these Chinese, about 10 of them, a contract firm, not naval ratings, just an official firm, and they did all their laundry in a compartment, I'd guess about 20 feet by 20 feet, and in that they did all this laundering, all the pressing, all the ironing, and they lived and slept and ate and had their whole existence in this tiny little compartment. Most amazing people, and anybody I think you will find who served in the Navy on the China station in the old days will have enormous liking and respect for these Chinese.
Did you ever come across the Japanese military presence in the Far East?
Yes, because we went to Shanghai a lot. Shanghai was a great whoopee place, and sometimes we used to see the Japanese ships in there then.
Did they appear to be of any kind of threat?
Yes, people were very apprehensive about them, very apprehensive about them. And just in answer to that question, there was one resident naval officer at Weihai Way, and he was the surgeon commander who was in charge of the sick quarters on Weihai Way Island. And when the war broke out against Japan, he worked, the anchorage was completely deserted, of course. He was the only naval officer there. And he woke up one morning and looked out from his balcony and saw the entire anchorage full of vast Japanese fleet. So he thought, well, I don't know what to do about this. So he got in his barge thing, his motorboat, and he went round till he saw something that looked like a flagship and went on board and saw the admiral, and there was an interpreter. And the admiral said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm the resident naval officer of Weihai Way." And he said, "Well, you'll take the next coaster, which is likely to be the last, and go on down to Hong Kong." And the commander replied, "I shall have to seek my instructions, Admiral." And the Japanese replied, "Those are your instructions." And he very wisely cleared out. And that was the last British presence in Weihai Way. That just to give you an indication of how old-fashioned things were in those days. When I was serving in HMS Cornwall, which in the same anchorage, I got appendicitis. And I was rolling around in the gunroom, in the deck in the gunroom, in absolute agony. And up came another old surgeon commander, a ship surgeon commander, and he said, "I think it's indigestion." He said, "I've got a cannonball in the sick bay, and I'll send it up to you, and if you roll it round your stomach, I think you will obtain relief." And I, you know, I couldn't make much sense of this. But the surgeon lieutenant, who was much younger and much newer and very, very newly joined and very tentative, with great courage, said, "Sir, do you think it's just possible that the midshipman has appendicitis?" Or, I don't know. And anyway, I had got appendicitis. So I was put into a thing like a sort of a big wooden tray, rather like a big coffin, on big wire slings, hoisted out by the aircraft crane and lowered into the pinnace, where I received by my own boat's crew, because my job at the time was running the ship's pinnace, and lowered down on the seats in the thwarts in this boat and chug ashore to the little landing place there, where I was carried very solicitously up the slippery steps by my boat's crew in this tray. And they didn't want to carry me and the tray all the way up to the sick quarters, so they hired a rickshaw, and I was balanced on top of this rickshaw with a sailor holding each corner, and we wound our way up through the woods to the sick quarters. Now, in the sick quarters, it was so primitive that there was no running water even, and every ship lying the anchorage had to land one barrel of fresh water to supply the sick quarters with the fresh water they needed each day. And it didn't matter how dirty and slimy the inside of the barrels were, that's where they got their water from. Of course, it was in the days of before, in the days when you had to have chloroform for anesthetic. And I remember when I was fighting my way out of this chloroform, I had an appalling pain in the leg. And I visualized very vividly this extraordinary old surgeon commander who had glasses as thick as the bottom of a lemonade bottle, slashing at my tummy to find the appendix and missing and hitting me in the thigh. That's what I imagined under the fumes of the anaesthetic. Anyway, all that happened was, because there were no proper nurses, they'd let me lie on a boiling hot water bottle which had burst, and I bear the scars of that, and it took a long time, a lot longer for that to heal up than the appendix scar to heal up. And when I was recovering, there were no nurses, I say. There were only these Chinese stewards. And one old chap who was in charge of them all used to bring me my meals and so on, and he was called Number Two. And I couldn't converse with him very much, more enough, but I asked the surgeon commander one day why he was called Number Two, and he said, well, because this is a very, very old established sick quarters, the Navy had been, you know, using Wei Highway for donkey's years. And there was one old Chinaman who was such an extraordinarily strong character, and he worked here for 30 or 40 years, I don't know, and he was Number One. And eventually he went away or died. And this young one, who'd been his assistant for so long, was so much in awe of him that he didn't feel it was correct to call himself Number One. So he was Number Two for the rest of his service too. Well, the routine was you spent Christmas at Hong Kong, and then the fleet all went up to Wei Hai Wei, where they had a very busy summer doing their exercises, gunnery firings, flying, and all the rest of it. And, of course, endless pulling regattas, hockey matches, swimming, and God knows what. Very good fun it was. An extraordinary, simple, healthy sort of a life, and I enjoyed every moment of it. But then, in the autumn, you'd go down to Shanghai with all your saved up pay. Incidentally, in those days we got 5 shillings a day pay. You saved that up, and when you got to Shanghai was the really whoopee time. And Shanghai was the sort of sin city of the world's history, I should think. The most extraordinary, extraordinary place. And there were these marvelous cabarets where you used to go and dance with the taxi dancers. A lot of them, of course, it was relatively recently after the Russian Revolution, and a lot of these poor Russian aristocrats had escaped to Shanghai, and their daughters would, in very hard times, would be employed in these cabarets, and nice girls they were. And, of course, you're raised in once and all the rest of it. Anyway, we had a high old time in Shanghai. And I remember running the officer's boat and lying alongside the Bund in Shanghai, waiting for the officers to come on board. And an extraordinary little number with 3-inch high heels came down and looked over into our boat And she said to the coxswain, a leading seaman, Pitman, I remember him to this day, "Excuse me, is Stoker Maxie Rill on board?" And I knew that Stoker Maxie Rill was my stoker in the engine room of my boat at the time, and I was just going to lean forward and shout into the engine room, "Stokes, there's somebody that wants to see you." But leading seaman Pitman, who was older and more experienced chap than me, beat me to it. He said, "Oh no, miss, I'm afraid Stoker Maxie Rowe is duty on board today. He won't be able to get ashore today, miss. I'm so sorry, miss." And so the girl went away, and I peered into the engine room. There was Stoker Maxie Rowe lying flat on the floorboards, hiding behind the engine box. And I thought, well, that's the sort of experience in which a 19-year-old boy learns to keep his mouth shut. And talking of these boats' crews, you had your own boat. You vied with every other boat in the fleet to keep it polished and shiny and buy special cushion covers for it and all the rest of it. And the interesting thing was your relationship with the coxswain, who was probably a very experienced leading seaman. And you were responsible. And if you'd run the boat into something and drown 70 Liberty men, you'd be the man who was court martialed, the midshipman would. But the other man was there to provide experience. And they were wonderful the way they played these ratings. They'd have some quite inexperienced midshipman who might or might not really know how to handle the boat. And every now and again he might clear his throat and say, "Perhaps we better go round again, sir," if you'd made a hash of coming alongside the gangway, you see. And the relationship with these chaps was fabulous, and it was more than just then. It gave one, I think, a fabulous opportunity to understand how a sailor thinks and what marvellous people they are, really, which you know is the basis of one's whole professional career. Time stood still. We were out there for 2 years or more, and it was, in my way of thinking, not only very enjoyable, but a marvellous basis of professional training on far more than a technical point, if you see what I mean. Far more than technical matters, if you see what I mean.
Were personnel from the fleet allowed to contract marriages with women from Shanghai and so on?
They didn't. They didn't. A lot of them, you know, were very old-time chaps. A lot of them would sit on board and make little wool mats and never go ashore at all. Others would go raging ashore. And it was, you see, there were brothels endlessly in Shanghai. And the one was set up in Wei Hai Wei. Suddenly the officers became aware that all the troops were madly keen on going off sailing in the whalers, which had never been before. And they always used to sail over to a place called Sun Island, where some enterprising enterprising Chinaman from the mainland had installed some girls. And you were talking about the Chinese government just now. There was a local Chinese admiral on the mainland. We didn't see anything of him, and he had appeared to have nothing to do and no ships or anything. But he did have two little ferries which ran across to the island of Wei Hai, 3 or 4 miles across the bay. And one of these things, I'm afraid rather typically, he laid up and took the money for running it and the wages and so on, and ran only one ferry instead, which was tremendously overcrowded. And one day that capsized as it approached Wei Hai Wei, and we had to salvage it for them later, but I think 80 sailors were drowned or something. And the joke that was going around was, well, this Chinese admiral had been court-martialed for losing 80 sets of uniform. In Shanghai was the base of a man called Rear Admiral Yangtze, and he was in charge of about a dozen of these China River gunboats that used to go way up the Yangtze River, up to 1,000 miles above Hankow. And they were very funny little ships. They looked more like smoothing irons than anything else. They had two officers and about perhaps 25 or 30 men, not more. And they had open engine rooms. You could see the cranks going round in the engine rooms. They had funny little brackets out over the stern for the heads. And they were very, very primitive. They had one 6-inch gun. And they were really the only force for law and order up and down all those thousands of miles of river. Their job was to protect the British trading interest, which were very numerous. We had a lot of trading firms up there then, particularly in Hankow. Unfortunately, I joined a ship which had just come down from the river, and I left one just before she went up, and I never actually went up myself. But I used to see a lot of these gunboat people, and they tell the most extraordinary stories. You see, the river will rise and fall 80 or 100 feet overnight. So you could be going along doing His Majesty's business one day, and then you'd be high and dry in a paddy field for 6 months the next, and no disgrace, you were just there. Or you'd go out and shoot snipe until the river came up again the next season. They had very big, high wireless aerials, but communications with them were pretty vague. Traditionally, the officers had nothing very much to do and used to fight with one another. The captain fought with the first lieutenant, and frequently there was a doctor there, and his job was really to keep the other two apart. But in the times of flood there, the river runs very, very fast, perhaps in the narrows, in the gorges they call it, 17 or 18 knots, I believe. And when the little ships, which would do a good turn of speed, if they came there and wanted to get up river against this against this ebb tide, would try, and if they failed to get past it because it was running too fast, they'd drop back again to the nearest village, and they'd put the word round, they'd collect perhaps 1,000 Chinamen, and there were galleries cut from time immemorial in these gorges, and they'd get a vast rope of plaited bamboo, and they'd try again the next morning with perhaps 1,000 men on the tow rope trudging along in the gallery, and with the ship going full speed they might just get through the narrows. If they got through, every man got a silver Maria Teresa dollar, which was the currency then. If they didn't get through, no pay, no cure, no pay. And that was the kind of marvelous arrangement one had with the Chinese. No troubles, whatever.
Coming back to Shanghai, what was the law and order situation there as far as you could observe?
There were, I think, 4 different cantons, as far as I remember. There was or concessions, they called them. There was a British concession, a French concession, an international concession, and then of course the great part of the city was just run by, I won't say the Chinese government, but it just happened in the way a Chinese city does. There was quite a big American presence there. There were American Marines there that had their headquarters in a glamorously named Bubbling Well Road. The place was just like an extraordinary antheap, and I remember going alongside the Bund on the south side of the river in HMS Cornwall and keeping watch on the quarter deck in the midship of the watch, and the children there, well, there would be scores of children scurrying round on the jetty, and whenever living exactly really like a pack of dogs, whenever our sailors threw rubbish overboard into the down the gas chute, they call it, into tubs or whatever it was on the jetty, these children would rush at this, fighting, scratching one another's eyes out for cabbage stalks, anything. And I saw them at night